ever had an inner realization that you'd arrive at some deep truth that you'd seen through the smoke and mirrors, and that somehow you'd discovered what was really the case? Well, that inner discovery of deep truth is our subject in this episode of The Good Life on ABC Radio and on your pod with me, Noel Debien. Gnosticism comes from a Greek word, gnosis, and it's one of the Greek words for knowledge. The ideas of the spark of enlightenment, or even just brilliance, can be charged with Gnostic significance. Gnosticism is a diffuse movement. It has many schools and many places of origin, but the idea of knowledge, secret knowledge or inner knowledge, is key to it. And those Gnostic ideas are very ancient. Think of the Zoroastrians, for example. And maybe you've heard of the Manichaeans, especially given St. Augustine of Hippo started his career as a Manichaean. You might have heard of the Gospel of Philip or some of those hidden Gospels. And you may have heard of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi texts. These have thrown a great deal of light on our modern understanding of what Gnosticism was and what it is now. Some of the historic Gnostic groups were very secretive. Think of the Cathars or the Albigensians. Even the Holy Grail has something to do with the ideas of Gnosticism, particularly if you're reading the Da Vinci Code. Well, it's true to say that Gnostic ideas are very, very persistent, and they often re-emerge in the middle of mainstream religions, including Christianity and especially Christianity. But Gnostic ideas have been seen as the enemy by Orthodox Christians over the centuries. And in the long expanse of history, lots of Gnostics have been executed by Christians. Well, there are still Gnostic movements and churches in existence, and this weekend, an Australian bishop, Tim Mansfield, has been consecrated by a group called the Joanite Church. The Apostolic Joanite Church is a Gnostic church based in the USA. It has seven sacraments, it celebrates a communion service, it celebrates baptism, and it has a structure of liturgy which is fairly clear, but its doctrines and ideas are based on the inner experience of the individual and are quite varied. The Good Life took the opportunity of Tim Mansfield's consecration this weekend to meet with two leading American Gnostic bishops to delve into some of the ways in which Gnosticism helps them make sense of their lives.
My name is William Behan. I'm the primate for North America for the Apostolic Joanite Church.
My name is Sean McCann. I serve as Patriarch of the Apostolic Joanite Church and have since 2003.
We're talking about a church which is approximately, I think, a decade old, really, but the ideas are much older. Can you give us a sense of the size and nature of the communities that exist in North America?
The North American communities tend to be very, very small. So we have some communities where regular attendance is three or four people, and they have a very tight-knit, very intimate community. We have larger communities where groups of, you know, up to 20 to 30, especially for lectures and special events. And then all told, we have just under 20 parishes and groups in the United States, and then I think over 20 in North America all told.
What was the drive to form these parishes? What's the history of like-mindedness or a wish to form communities that created these?
There's no one single identifiable impetus, but rather there is a need on the part of oftentimes singular individuals to find people that share their interests and their orientation spiritually. And so they form these groups often as study groups or as reading groups. And then those study groups and reading groups grow into larger faith communities just as a result of finding a shared interest and a shared bond among those people.
Your own path into becoming involved in a Gnostic church movement, how did it happen for you?
I was raised Roman Catholic, and so I still to this day have a strong love for Catholicism, especially for its history and the way that it has cultivated an intellectual and a theological tradition. But I found that in my late teens, early 20s, I think like many of us, I went through a number of different exploratory phases until I found the esoteric dimension of Christianity allowed me to preserve what I loved so much about my home faith tradition while still experiencing something that went significantly beyond that. And it took many years to find a way to orient myself to an organization or to discover an organization that really had those same kinds of goals and interests. And I think I, like so many people who identify themselves as Gnostics, never convert to Gnosticism. Nobody ever converts to Gnosticism. You discover that you were a Gnostic all along, and that lo and behold, there are a bunch of other people that have these same sorts of ideas and these same sorts of experiences, and suddenly there's this wonderful unfolding that happens where you say, oh, I'm not alone, I'm not by myself in these, and I can make sense of these experiences in a very real and concrete way, and then begin to have a real impact on our communities.
What was the step-by-step process of becoming part of this church?
First of all, my studies in university were in philosophy primarily, and in my secular profession, I'm a lecturer in philosophy. And there was never a real divide for me between what I was doing academically and what I wanted to pursue spiritually. So starting in, I guess, the late 1980s, early 1990s, I began searching for organizations, fraternal organizations and church organizations that spoke to the experiences that I was coming to understand and give voice to in my philosophical work. So I studied tarot, and I looked at the Golden Dawn, and I looked at various other organizations. And I guess in the mid-1990s, found myself involved with a small group in Chicago that had a much stronger ecclesiastical orientation. And it was through them that I was originally ordained and eventually consecrated. And when that group sort of dissolved, people moved away, people took different paths. I found a home in the Apostolic Johannite Church. And when I found the AJC, it was very much this experience of coming home, very much finding a place that spoke precisely to the delicate balance between having a structure and having a tradition and having an intellectual framework in which to work, and also within that framework, just the most extraordinary freedom and the most extraordinary generosity on the part of the organization in discovering one's own path.
Your path to becoming part formally of the church?
I had grown up Christian in a very, you know, strict Dutch Calvinist kind of fashion because half my family is Dutch. I grew up in Manitoba. And, you know, it was kind of the place where the supernatural or the miraculous or even the to tone it down, the spiritual, you know, didn't really happen. You put on your suit, you put on your tie, you went to church, you took communion, you recited the creed simply from the perspective of this is what your family and the generations did before you. This is what your friends did. So it was a part of fitting in, but there was nothing where you really had a sense of ownership of your own spirituality or a participation in the community that would give that spirituality its language. So in my teens, I wandered away from there, and as most teens do when they wander, you know, I wandered into, you know, trouble and experimentation and better living through chemistry and all sorts of fun. I was very fortunate to survive that, but as somebody who was deeply spiritual and struggling to reconcile my mistakes with a sense of the sacred, with a sense of purpose, you know, how could I have done this? How could I end up on this path, and how did I survive? I found myself quite alone. There wasn't really anybody I could talk to or identify with or somebody, you know, willing to say, I see you for who you are, warts and all. Why don't you come have a seat, a cup of coffee, and tell me how you got here? Despite having lots of friends and family, people I could talk to, there was nobody I could identify with. I was looking for, you know, a community or a place to really be the person or the thing I didn't have during that time. And also at the same time, feeling very grateful to come out of that situation, you know, alive and sane. I wanted to turn around and give back a little bit and kind of be an ear, a shoulder, and a voice for people who didn't feel they had a place to exercise those things. I figured, you know, I'm not not smart enough to be a teacher, not steady enough or patient enough to be a doctor. I can listen, because I always counted myself as a spiritual being. So, you know, I can listen, I can walk with people, I can help them on their journey. As it turned out, the church that I joined, the church that I participated in, filled that role for me as I got back on my own spiritual, emotional, mental and physical feet. And so, you know, I ended up turning around.
What was the step-by-step process of meeting the Joanite Church have for you?
You know, I had already explored a lot of the local churches and communities, you know, a couple more fringy than us, New Age spirituality, more traditional Catholicism, Anglo-Catholicism, Anglicanism. There were lots of little things within each of those communities and traditions that I identify with. You know, I like the idea of the sacraments, of a liturgical church, something that embodies the sacred through mundane symbols that we can understand, the idea of incense, of bread and wine, and robes and lighting and music and art. It was just a matter of where could I find a place that kind of embodied all these aspects in one package, but wasn't also stuck to that package, where, you know, it could evolve as your own sense of spirituality involved. Well, after I was done looking on the street and looking in the back of magazines, you look on the internet. And I was able to come in contact with the man who is now my predecessor in this role, Bishop James Foster. And I wrote to him, I said, you know, how do I get involved? There was nothing in my area. He was located in Ohio. Does that count as Midwestern? I'm Canadian. So I ended up writing, and I said, you know, how do I get involved? I'd like to do this thing. I would like to see this kind of community that embraces these ideals and has this kind of freedom to recognize the spiritual experience and the gnosis of individual beings. How do I do this back home? How do I get involved? You know, I don't just want to sit in the pews. I want to be a priest. He outlined a series of steps, and essentially what I did is I went into a period of reading for orders, or, you know, old school priestly apprenticeship, you know, sweeping mental floors and washing sinks, you know, first of all my own. And after spending a significant period of time doing that, I traveled to the States for retreat, was ordained, got to connect with a lot of other people that I hadn't had a chance to meet, connect face to face, and essentially take that flame that they had kindled, put it, you know, on my own candle and very carefully, with hands around, take it back home.
What's the connection between the classical Gnosticism that I read of, the Nag Hammadi texts, the Dead Sea Scrolls for that matter, which connect to a Jewish esoteric belief as well, and who you are now in 2012 as the Joanite Church?
I don't think I could easily put that into a short enough package. But I think that one of the most important things is that the Apostolic Joanite Church has always looked backwards, forwards, and inwards, that we've connected to the much older tradition, and that very much includes classical Gnosticism as well as the mainstream Christian tradition, looking forward to progressive ideals and 21st century mentality. We're in no real sense a historical continuation of any particular Gnostic sect or Gnostic group. So we're not Valentinians, for example.
That I understand, but the ideas are old. I mean, whether
yes.
or not there's a handing on personally, the ideas are very old.
That's exactly right. I think that there is a shared sensibility that what we are doing now is what they were doing then. Or if I can be so bold as to say, what we're doing now is what they would be doing were they here now. If they were in this particular cultural milieu, what the first and second century Gnostics were encountering and what they were trying to give voice to is precisely the same kind of experience of the world to which we're trying to give voice.
In a sense, Gnosticism, the traditional Gnosticism, was an attempt to make sense of evil in the world. And early Gnostics, for example, certainly a distinct group, believed that the God of the Christians, the God of the Jews, was not really God, because this God permitted evil and suffering. People died, disease happened. So that can't really be God. The real God was hidden. Mm-hmm. And this God that the Christians talked about was like a demiurge, a sub-God. Now, is that still part of your set of beliefs?
I don't think it's part of our beliefs in a literal or concrete fashion. Nonetheless, I think there is an emphasis on the importance of, call it the spiritual, call it the virtual, call it the transcendent, over the material, the everyday. And I think that what they were trying to account for was this relationship. What gives rise to this distinction that we have between spirit and matter? the division is still very, very present. And so there is, of course, a tendency to think of Gnosticism merely as world-hating. Oh, the world is evil, the world is bad, it's created by this demiurge, Yeldabaoth, or whomever you want to identify that with, and what's important is spirit, what's important is the pleroma, the fullness, what's important is the hidden god, the alien god, the ineffable. What that speaks to is a feeling of fundamentally not being at home in the world, that the world is occasionally an obstacle for our spiritual development, where I think we part ways in a decided fashion from those classical Gnostics is that we have a much greater sense of the beauty of the world as well, that the fullness of creation in its spiritual sense also shows itself through the material world, that the material world is not evil, the material world is not an obstacle, it is the place in which we find the hidden father, it's the place in which we find the presence of the alien god, it's hidden, not somewhere else, but right in front of us.
You just said the hidden father, the alien god. Now that sounds like you are agreeing with an idea that God is ineffable, God is unknowable in the sense that Christians claim he's knowable, he's not.
When we talk about the alien god, it's that there is a distance between any conception we might have of God and what God truly is. That any time we try to anthropomorphize God, any time we say, well, God is father, well, we've limited God in a way that God can never be limited. If we say, well, God is mother, we've limited it in another way. God is whatever it is. We always are getting a glimpse of it and never the whole thing. And what the image of the alien God or the image of the ineffable father represents is the totality, which can never be encapsulated in human thought.
See, this idea of transcendence that you're talking about here, though, is also, I think, by analogy, the reason why you could argue that Gnosticism sits within orthodoxy all the time. Catholics, Anglicans, Calvinists, if you talk to them, Jews, you'll find Gnostic tendencies among them all, you could argue.
If you look at Augustine, for example, if we're going to talk about the problem of theodicy or the problem of evil in the world, this is something that Augustine is grappling with, and he ultimately betrays some of his own Manichaean upbringing, I think, in thinking about the way that God can permit evil to be in the world and that where this evil comes from.
Well, the Manichaeans were antimatter. That the actual physical world was evil. And Augustine was, Augustine of Hippo, the founder of Western Christianity, arguably, was originally one of these, in inverted commas, heretics, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And what I find absolutely wonderful about reading Augustine, I love seeing his journey taking place and unfolding in his texts. And I think that there are, in some ways, that he never fully lets that division between spirit and matter go, that that becomes part of his theology, even if it's not given the radical dualist expression that it is in Manichaeanism. And then, by extension, the Western Christian tradition inherits that as well. So there's nothing really radical about saying, well, spirit transcends matter. Any Roman Catholic agrees with that. Any Anglican agrees with that. Any Orthodox agrees with that. Any Lutheran agrees with that. That's part and parcel of Christianity in a very real sense. I think it's radicalized in the early Gnostics. I think that we interpret it in a slightly different way than the early Gnostics do. But it is still in play in a very real sense.
Well, you could argue that John Calvin is a pure Augustinian. You were raised effectively in an Augustinian dualism between spirit and body, I think.
Yeah, I was raised with the whole, you know, total depravity of man and I guess it was that very black and white sense of things, particularly the determined aspect of it, the predestination.
That comes straight out of the later Augustine.
Yeah, it was one of those things that actually, a reaction to that drove me into the arms of Gnosticism. To say that, well, there is a certain degree of determinism, that you have a participation in your own salvation. It's not written, that you get to co-author it with the divine, if you will.
Sean McCann and William Behan there, American bishops of the Johannite Church.